our event of the year, in our second year. And today, it's my pleasure to introduce today's speaker. I'll just tell you a little bit about him and then let him speak for himself and with his work. But so Doug Ullman, as many of you know, is a professor in the Department of Economics and in the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. He has worked generally on issues relating to children's health, and in particular is very interested in sort of how conditions and resources very early in a child's life, including before birth, affect their long-term outcomes and prospects, and is a theme running throughout his papers. I do want to, I don't usually do this, but because we have this interdisciplinary group and a lot of students, I want to make a particular plug for one of his recent papers, which is this piece in the Journal of Economic Perspectives by Janet with Janet Curry and Doug. And it's, for those of you who don't know, also a plug for an econ journal. The Journal of Economic Perspectives is a sort of more general interest. It's not targeted at academic economists, but is supposed to be a bit less technical and more accessible, and has some really great pieces, including this piece in from 2011 by Doug and his co-author Janet Curry. I always, when I do these introductions, I like to look through the CV to find something, you know, odd and quirky and of interest. And on Doug's, I found that his favorite expression is "nature abhors a vacuum." You might want to ask him about that after. And also, I did find that he shares something in common with me, which is that before grad school, he worked as a research assistant in Mathematica Policy Research. I find these people sprinkled throughout our profession, and it's another success story from that path. So with that, Doug will talk to us about a whole set of his work today, and we'd like to welcome him.
Okay, thank you. So thank you for that very nice introduction, and thank you for hosting me, Anne and Mary Ann, this week. It's been a great visit so far, and, you know, it compares well with all my other visits, and the one that I think of is the one to Beijing 10 years ago to NBR conference, where I felt I was treated particularly well, and your hosting, I think, is at that high level. Beijing 10 years ago.
There's a hotel, and
just to frighten Hillary a little bit, I'll also add to my sort of CV that I was Hillary's student at Berkeley X years ago. So apologies in advance for this talk. So in econ, the rules of engagement are you're welcome to interrupt me at any time, so please feel free to do that. I won't take it as rude or anything like that. And as suggested, I'm going to sort of do a sort of uber discussion of some of the recent and important work on fetal origins. Okay, so by way of motivation, obviously I think there's an audience where we think that childhood is very important, and there are lots of 9-month periods in our life that are very important. So a month ago, our daughter Abigail started kindergarten at the Columbia School, and she has an awesome teacher, and she's learning a lot. Actually, she's learning much more than I thought she would. I wasn't sure she was going to buy into it, but she's really coming home every day with something new she's learned that she wants to tell me. So this is going to be a very important 9 months. What I think the fetal origins hypothesis asks us to do is to think about 5 years ago, because she's actually starting kindergarten age 4, when she was in utero. And how important was that 9-month period relative to this very important 9-month period right now? And so this is a picture of her in utero. Okay. With consent of the mom, I'll tell you. So the fetal origins hypothesis basically says that the prenatal foundation lays the foundation on which the rest of childhood is built. And I saw this definition recently, which I liked from Seckel, which is referring to fetal programming as the action of a factor during a sensitive period or window of development to exert organizational effects that persist throughout life. Okay, so something, so fundamental architecture is being affected. And as the next point repeats, these outcomes persist throughout the rest of life. So with, you know, many other interventions, people are concerned about fade out over time. And fetal origins is a place where from the get-go, we're thinking less about fade out, partly for just the practical reason is the early analyses are looking at stuff that happened very early on and then looking at adult outcomes. So sort of while there may be fade out, it's not going to be complete fade out because we're still finding effects in adulthood. In epidemiology, and we discussed sort of the role of the epidemiological literature more in this JEP article that Ann nicely mentioned. It's often associated with a physician named D.J. Barker, and he did a lot of sort of original data analysis in England, looking at correlations and regression-adjusted correlations between measures of early life health and later life chronic health conditions. This work by Barker some 20 years ago was actually a reaction against an earlier literature which viewed the fetus as the perfect parasite. So basically, if there was adversity during the prenatal period, the mom was a very good buffer, and she sort of absorbed the bad event and protected the fetus. Smoking rates into the 1950s and 1960s in the U.S. were something like, you know, going up to around 50% during pregnancy, and it was by many people's reckonings the thalidomide episode which sort of shattered this notion that the mom is protecting the fetus from every insult. So a natural question is what matters to the fetus and its long run outcomes in utero, and the original hypothesis that came to us again from epidemiology focused on prenatal nutrition and how much and what the mother eats. The most studied famine in probably both economics and in epidemiology is the Dutch famine of 1944 to 1945. And there are a couple of reasons why this famine was sort of particularly appealing to analyze. One is that it was a fairly short famine and fairly unexpected. So the Netherlands did pretty well, despite being occupied, until the Nazis cut off food shipments, and then there was a sudden and unexpected famine. And furthermore, it happened in a country that actually had good data. Usually we have famines in places where the data are pretty bad. So those are a couple of reasons why these cohorts have been particularly studied. And what do they find? Well, they find a whole host of chronic health conditions in adulthood that are compromised. The initial studies looked at cognitive outcomes among military recruits, and that was back in 1975, and didn't find much. But as these cohorts have aged, they found heart disease, hypertension, obesity, all these things responding to the prenatal environment. One sort of piece of subtext here that I'm probably more interested in than other people is this literature has been actually pretty contentious within epidemiology. And one of the reasons why I think it's been contentious within epidemiology is the role of birth weight, okay? So the cohort that seems to be most negatively affected by the Dutch famine tends to be those exposed during the first half of pregnancy, whereas when you look at the birth outcomes of the Dutch famine, the ones with the largest decrease in birth weight are those exposed in the second half of pregnancy. So there are a lot of people who really thought that the Dutch famine, the exclusion restriction should hold for birth weight, that birth weight should pick up the long-run effect of the famine, and that wasn't being found. So granted they have a good natural experiment, but people are sort of kind of confused at why birth weight wasn't the metric to capture that. And I think now, over the last couple of years, people have said, well, you know, this sort of says that there's a need for other metrics. And that's actually going to be a point I come back to a couple times later, is a real challenge in this literature is the absence of a good early life metric. Because we're forced to look at these, if we're really going to analyze long-run effects, we have to go back in time to look at a historical event or treatment back in the past. If we had that metric, we wouldn't have to be doing economic history all the time, okay? But in the absence of such a metric, we're sort of forced to do that. Okay, so now I'm going to sort of wave the economics flag a little bit here. What are the contributions economists have made to this field? So I'll sort of try and distill these into three, and then talk about more recent work. One is to say it's not just about famines. It's more general than thinking about famine exposures. Not to say famines aren't important and ongoing, and they're, you know, obviously they're very important for the history of human evolution, etc. But economists have sort of, in some sense, been a little bit liberated from the biology to consider other things that the epidemiologists hadn't really posited mechanisms for. Secondly, economists are very interested in things other than health. So, actually the original incarnation of my job market paper was looking at health outcomes. And then I sort of thought, you know, it'd actually be even more interesting to consider things like wages and that sort of thing. And in some sense, the data in the census were particularly well suited to that. So expanding beyond health to consider a whole manner of other things. And then the third thing, which, you know, probably I'll talk about more than I should, is about the convincingness of the evidence. So I'll briefly develop these three points before proceeding to sort of some of the more recent literature. So famine's effects, you know, famine is a very severe event, and in some sense, if you do something sufficiently bad to a mom while she's pregnant, it's kind of plausible that there would be an injury, okay? And so what economists have done is consider things that aren't quite as severe as famines. And so one of the things economists have looked at is the disease environment. So looking at, you know, pandemic influenza and malaria exposure, wartime stress, ionizing radiation, a whole gamut of early life exposures beyond famine have been studied. So it seems to be more general than just about famine. Secondly, as mentioned, people have looked at a lot of other outcomes besides just health outcomes, not to say health isn't important, but things like test scores. So the whole literature, you know, obviously is concerned with educational inputs and impacts on test scores. Well, you know, we can sort of engage that literature a little bit by saying, you know, what are the effects of income during early childhood on test scores or that sort of thing. And the thing that gets many education economist people kind of upset, maybe not upset's not quite the right word, but is that the impacts tend to be often as large or larger than conventional educational interventions, okay? So despite the brevity of the prenatal period, you can really have some outsized effects on things like test scores. Going beyond test scores to educational attainment, wages and incomes, and then other sort of more demographic stuff like whether you get married, the characteristics of your spouse, and the neighborhood you live in, welfare dependency, just, it actually, in some sense, becomes a problem, this big range of things that are affected, because it sort of restricts the set of falsification exercises we can perform, because it's not so obvious what should not be affected when you sort of, when you trigger something during the prenatal period. Okay. Then the third thing is, like, why should you believe this? And there, you know, this sort of sounds like astrology in the sense, you know, you're born at this particular time under a certain star, and then, like, this is how your life is going to be. And it's not just that. I think there is a lot of astrology-caliber research out there on the fetal origins hypothesis. And you know, people have heard this before, but I would say, you know, the modal study in fetal origins is equating correlation with causation. I think that generated some of the controversy within epidemiology. At the risk of being just pedantic, you know, it's not just correlation is not the same as causation. You can do regression analysis with a ton of control variables, and still, I'm not very convinced that we're getting closer to sort of causal inference there. So the paper that I'd like to sort of plug here just randomly, and I feel kind of comfortable doing this because this is actually not by an economist, despite what the title is, you know, if you're in the situation where you think you might have omitted variables bias, does including more regressors help reduce that bias? And I think, you know, the usual prior on that is if I control for more stuff, I reduce bias. And this paper makes the point that that's really not the case. Okay? You can actually often increase bias by sort of kitchen sinking your regression. And what they point to and what I'm going to turn to next is, you know, you'd like to be in a situation where what you control for really doesn't matter that much to the effect you're estimating. And so research design is sort of an alternative to sort of, you know, kitchen sinking our regression. Okay, so example one, and I apologize for taking these examples that are close to home, is the 1918 influenza in the United States. So one of the things that is notable about the 1918 influenza is it really appeared out of nowhere. This is September 1918 number of deaths per month, and then we, you know, go up by more than an order of magnitude in October of 1918. So this is just something that hit suddenly and out of blue, and after, you know, it was a really scary 4 or 5 months, and, you know, hundreds of thousands of people died, but after 4 or 5 months, you get back down to sort of, you know, fairly normal death rates in the U.S., okay? So if you think about the cohort that was, you know, born, say, around here, born around here, they were conceived prior to the arrival of the pandemic, so we don't think that their conception decision was affected by expectation of this flu, but they were very likely to have a mom who got infected with the 1918 flu. So while it is the case that millions died from the 1918 flu, that's actually not the most common thing that happened. The most common thing that happened is you got infected, you were sick for a little while, and then you got better and you lived. So something like 1/3 of pregnant mothers got sick, whereas fewer than 1% of mothers died. To the extent that mothers did die or weak fetuses died, that's actually going to bias against us finding effects. So there is a culling effect that we need to sort of have floating around, particularly for famine episodes where mortality rates are even higher. But that's, you know, at least at first pass, that's going to bias us against finding anything. So the question the flu paper asks is, if you happen to be in utero in the U.S. during the 1918 flu and conceived prior, how are you doing later in life? Well, so this is where the census data comes in, and so if you look in the 1960 census data, so this is 42 years after the flu pandemic, this plots the average educational attainment by the year of birth, okay? And there's this upward trend. So people in the U.S. Were getting more education over time. Part of that, I think, is due to the compulsory school laws that are inducing, you know, later born cohorts to have more schooling. But the striking thing about this is you can sort of do the visual detrending. You see that the cohort born in 1919 is substantially off that trend, okay? And we can do a couple of additional comparisons. One is we can sort of dummy out this average drop for the 1919 cohort and look using the information on where people were born to see if in a difference in differences analysis, if being born in a state that had a worse pandemic leads to a larger decrease here. So a bigger drop here than if you were in a state with a milder pandemic. So, you know, that helps to address concerns about, oh gosh, it was the end of the World War One. Maybe there are other changes. So those changes would have to be correlated with the severity of the pandemic around the U.S., which fortunately for analysis purposes was pretty idiosyncratic. We can also carry this forward to 1980. When these guys are in their early 60s and we see about, you know, 20% more likely to be disabled if the mom was infected with flu and greater than 5% reduction in wages. Okay. Example number two is looking at Chernobyl fallout in Sweden. So again, we sort of have a similar figure here that this is the gamma radiation in sort of central eastern Sweden plotted daily 1985 and 1986. And what you see again is this huge spike that's, you know, shorter than the spike for the 1918 flu. And we can think about those cohorts that happened to be in utero at the time. Now, Sweden wasn't considered a Chernobyl hotspot. Yes, sorry.
You know, when you first introduced the flu, you know, you
you were careful to say that the you know, many folks would, you know, many of the affected kids would already, the fertility choice would already have been made.
Yep.
And that's real helpful.
Yep.
For getting the convincing part right.
Yep.
But, and I'm, you know, you may be talking about this later, but of course you also need to worry a bit about survival to birth.
Yep.
And how that might play in. In any, in, you know, it's a challenge in most any of these kinds of empirical settings that you're looking at.
Yep.
So I wonder whether you might want to just talk about that challenge or whether you're going to talk about it later.
Right. So that's exactly right. So I think the more plausible bias, as opposed to people anticipating it,
right,
is that there is a selection effect. Fetuses are very vulnerable.
Right.
And so you just have part of the distribution that's getting sucked out by the event itself, and then we have sort of a survivor bias,
right,
later on in life. Okay, so let me give sort of a half answer to that. Depending on the thing considered, we may not have the data to look at fetal mortality and that, and particularly during 1918, that's tough. And so what people have done and what we've done is to look at the number of births. So basically, if you account for sort of smooth trends in number of births, we should see a smaller cohort, you know, if say fetal mortality peaks, you know, in the first trimester or something like that, then we should see a smaller cohort. It turns out these things seem to be, this in particular seems to be sufficiently mild where we don't get fetuses vanishing. Where that will change, and I'll come to that in a second, kind of surprisingly, is Ramadan. You see a lot of missings there. So maybe I can come back to that a little bit, but that's exactly right. I think that's much more, particularly fetal mortality, because, you know, obviously childhood mortality can increase as well, but that base level is so low that you're really stretched to generate, you know, much of an effect with childhood mortality. It would really have, I think the thing I usually worry about is the fetal mortality, because those rates are just much higher.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. And a lot of people talk about the fertility piece, which I think for the most part, time and time again, we reject that that's what's changing.
Exactly. I totally agree. And, yes, so that's right, and we'll come back to this a little bit with Ramadan. With particularly with this, we're pretty confident we don't have to worry too much about that. I think the intuition still generally goes through,
right,
that those that are most likely to die off are coming from the bottom of the distribution, and so that's gonna lead to attenuated effects in general. Yeah, but we'd like to know what those are, right? Like, because we'd like to. That's interesting in and of itself.
I just have before you switch to this slide, at the end of the last slide, you mentioned you said if the mothers had flu. You don't know if
we absolutely do not. So the very nice catch. Yeah.
So one thing that would have been differenced out in a state by state or region by region research design is stress on medical resources, because so it might be that the resources are moved away from prenatal care, or that people stay away from hospitals because they don't want to risk infection.
You're exactly right. And so a related point is, can we say that this was because the mom got influenza? Not really. Like, it could be just in places where there was high influenza infection rate, it was very stressful to be pregnant, and it could be that it literally was that. Had we the data to observe, which influenza wasn't a reportable disease, we cannot observe the thing that which you very smartly caught, which is that we don't observe the individual and to see whether it was really those people that were infected that are showing the long-term damage. That's absolutely right. So we cannot reject those things which mimic the variation of the pandemic. Now, prenatal care I'm not so worried about at this time as a confounder, because births tend to be outside of hospitals, and there, I guess I have more questions about sort of what prenatal care does. But stress, I can't rule out stress for 1918 flu. I really can't. Here we have sort of an analogous type of comparison, and what we have in Sweden, which we didn't have in the U.S. is we basically have a lot more data to throw at the problem. Okay, so what we can do here is look at things like, is there a heterogeneity by family background, or what does it look like within the family? Okay, so we can do the comparisons in Sweden of, were you a sibling that was exposed prenatally to Chernobyl fallout while the other sibling was not? So that's sort of a departure from the previous work in fetal origins, which, yes, did sibling fixed effects, but in the absence of an identification strategy. This is sort of sibling fixed effects with an identification strategy. And an interesting thing, which I'm going to come back to in a little bit, is those estimates with the fixed effects and without the fixed effects, I, going into this, would have thought they'd be the same. Okay? That was just sort of like an extra control variable. It was robust to inclusion of some additional controls. It's actually not the case. Largest effects on math scores for these cohorts, which lines up to an earlier literature on the A-bomb drops on Japan and IQ of cohorts sort of around the hypocenter of the A-bomb drops. And they find the largest effects on sort of measures of IQ. Math maps most closely to IQ. We find it at these radiation doses that people thought should be harmless. And we don't see things on sort of more English or Swedish or language type things. It seems to be sort of heaping mainly onto the math. What I was going to say about the sibling fixed effects is I was surprised to see that when we do the sibling fixed, we actually find much stronger within family estimates than when we do comparisons that also include across families. And I'll come back to that point in a little bit. Because that was a big surprise and it was a real puzzle. What I think it motivates, and Sweden's not the best place to do this because we don't have good data on parental investments that I know of, is to think about how parental investments respond to fetal origins. Okay, so policy implications. Avi Ebenstein, who's another Berkeley PhD, I'm not sure which of my papers he was ripping on. I think it was probably a famine paper. And he said, so what's the policy implication of this, that we shouldn't have famines? Like, we kind of already knew that one. which this is a pretty fair point, right? Like, I'm not going to convince anyone to not have a famine or a flu pandemic because, you know, in 50 years people aren't gonna make as much money. You know, like we already know this is like a policy failure of some kind. So this is sort of the making the rubble bounce. Like who, you know, it's not gonna be pivotal for policy that pandemics have long-term effects. So what that has motivated is a consideration of, you know, less extreme events. So things that are less extreme and more commonly experienced. So in a way, this is sort of circling back to the earlier literature. So the earlier literature did look at less extreme events. So like there were studies of this 1958 British cohort and what's its birth weight and how are these guys doing later in life. The variation in birth weight wasn't that, you know, famine-induced birth weight. This was just like cross-sectional variation in birth weight. So you could think that was the less extreme variation. The problem was, you know, we really, or I at least really think that those types of comparisons are really set up for omitted variables bias, that birth weights correlate with all sorts of other stuff that's important that, you know, we're not sure we're doing a great job of sweeping out, absent in an experiment. So I think at this point, this literature that did use less extreme events, you know, 15 or 20 years ago, was in the absence of the sort of identification strategy revolution, it's viewed kind of as descriptive, which isn't to say it's like lousy. It's to say, you know, it motivated a lot of people to work on this. And so it documents some interesting associations, but to sort of really put the knife in, people have gone to the natural experiments. And the challenge here is, can we sort of maintain the generality of the exposures considered and still have some identification strategy? That's the tension, I think. And I think that, you know, from my perspective, the literature has kind of succeeded in making this jump. It will require some larger data sets, but we'll come to that in a little bit. So, again, sort of being narcissistic and perhaps lazy, prenatal fasting during Ramadan. Okay, the Ramadan fast is determined by daylight hours. And there are various studies that say the total number of calories doesn't change. It's just the timing of nutrition. Okay? And then, you know, I'll come to this in a second, but they're nice reasons, for considering, the Ramadan fast from an identification standpoint. There's recent work by, Courtney Ward. She has a number of papers looking at seasonal influenza. So again, something that's not as traumatic as pandemic. And there's also stuff on weather and sort of a host of sort of milder, more commonly experienced exposures. I guess I would say, you know, the Chernobyl thing might tell us something about radon. So, like, a lot of people are exposed to radon, and that's pretty low-level ionizing radiation. Maybe we think that there is some general to that. So this is, I would say, still a developing literature, but there are these sort of well-identified studies that consider things that are mild that might actually be pivotal for sort of whether we decide to sort of participate or not participate in, you know, this type of mild exposure as opposed to something more serious. So this is a paper from, I guess, like a year ago, where we use Ramadan. Bashman Zumrad and I use Ramadan as a natural experiment. And the nice thing about Ramadan for analysis purposes is that it moves around the calendar. Okay, so I could never remember when Ramadan was, and it turns out the reason why I could never remember when Ramadan was because it was like moving 11 days every year. So we know that there are seasonal effects of seasonal effects on health, so birth outcomes and even long run outcomes are differing depending on when you were born. Well, we can sort of sop out those seasonal differences and focus on sort of the idiosyncratic movement of Ramadan around the calendar. And furthermore, we can also use variations stemming from the definition of the fast as being during daylight hours. So, you know, if you're off the equator, unfortunately Uganda's on the equator, so we don't get that variation, and we do analyze Uganda. But if you're in Michigan or, you know, somewhere else, then you get that daylight variation as well, and we can sort of take an additional difference and see that effects indeed are larger when you're supposed to be fasting for longer. So we do two things here. One is we look at birth outcomes in Michigan, and then we sort of make the jump of looking to other countries that, and we're looking at Iraq and Uganda purely for data reasons. So maybe this sort of drives home the point of the data challenges with fetal origins research, that to implement an identification strategy like this, you want to know, you'd ideally like to know people's religion. You'd like to know exactly when they're born. Like, often you just have age. Age isn't going to cut it. Year of birth isn't going to cut it. You want at least quarter of birth and preferably month of birth. And the reason why we're in Uganda and Iraq is because they actually report the month of birth on the censuses, and Uganda reports the religion. So then we can sort of move forward from there. You can ignore the bottom. So Esther asked us to do this sort of, I think, in the spirit of a randomized controlled trials, is basically just conduct a balance test. So if you look over here, the nice thing about Ramadan is if you compare those births where there was exposure, so the effect of Ramadan occurring at any time during pregnancy on maternal education, it doesn't look like there's any difference. You can look just the Arabs in Michigan or the non-Arabs. It doesn't look like there's any differential likelihood by maternal education of having a birth during Ramadan. So it doesn't seem like, which maybe is a, actually this was a surprise when I presented at Chicago. People, I don't believe that people don't time their births with regard to Ramadan. Well, it doesn't look like they time their births with regard to Ramadan. So we get fat zeros here, and so we're sort of, we're breaking that link, which is very robust between SES and health with this natural experiment. So it does, so in the end, it's not gonna matter whether we control for education or not. Okay, that's sort of the, that's the game, is to sort of find a situation where, you know, what you control for is, you know, once you've identified that variation or isolated that variation, it's important that what you control for doesn't really matter that much. Nevertheless, we find impacts on birth weight. Okay, so, these aren't like honking big noticeable effects on birth weight, if this was your baby or something, but they're significant. So it suggests that there is indeed a first stage, that moms are observing the fast. Now, one thing to mention, and I actually didn't quite know where this fits in the presentation, but I wanted to flag it nonetheless, is pregnancy recognition. So, and maybe it's actually a good time to mention this right after having said what do they think at the University of Chicago. So University of Chicago, I don't think they'd be thinking so much about what are the policies, you know, we can do to sort of improve fetal health, as much as, you know, how can we give moms the information to make better informed decisions? And there is evidence from epidemiology that once moms know they're pregnant, their behavior changes, okay? And the big effects we find for Ramadan are actually, you know, in that, basically in that first month or two of pregnancy. So most of these moms don't know they're pregnant and they're fasting. Okay, if they knew they were pregnant a little earlier, then maybe maybe they wouldn't fast, or maybe they wouldn't do other things. But if you look at, you know, the host of sort of lifestyle things, dieting, you know, drinking, smoking, these things, you know, change once people recognize they're pregnant. But that first little window before people learn they're pregnant can still be really important. So I think that's something that, like, we could agree with the Chicago people, that fostering earlier pregnancy recognition would cause individual behavioral change, but, you know, might also be, something we can target with policy, as well. Okay. So, yes, we found long run effects of that.
How's that evident in those results? You get the same.
Yes. So that's for birth weight. Where you really see the, is in the long run effects. Those totally heap on.
Yeah.
Here's exactly. So this, I see this as showing that there was a first stage, but again, like I never see a very.
Not the channel.
Yeah, that's not the channel.
Not the only one.
Doesn't it? Not the only one. Exactly. Exactly.
Do you have data on gestational age? Because I wonder if you know what's wrong.
Yeah. Right. So we do know gestational age, not in Uganda or Iraq, but we do know it in Michigan. And so we can assign Ramadan one of two ways. The dumb way, which is just to sort of count back and assume a, you know, normal pregnancy. Or we can use that exact, well, depending on who you ask, but date of last menses is the usual thing that people use to do it. Or they can do a clinical estimate of gestation. It turns out whether we do that, use that information or forget about that information, it doesn't really matter. We throw out about, I think, like 15% of our sample when we do that. It does look like there is a small effect on the duration of gestation, but most of this effect is conditional on gestation length, so intrauterine growth retardation. The point I want to make with this next slide here is essentially this is this is a study from Chicago. There's nothing to do with Ramadan per se. It's just about breakfast skipping. Okay. So what they did is they had pregnant moms, and they let them have dinner the night before, and then they brought them in, you know, like at 6 a.m. the following morning, 7 a.m. Okay. And then they monitored their blood biochemistry over time. Okay, and what was the really startling finding, if you look at glucose or free fatty acids, all this stuff, you see that as the fast, you know, extends from 12 hours, 14 hours, 16 hours, 18 hours, the blood biochemistry stays pretty stable in the non-pregnant population, but it goes pretty haywire in the non-pregnant population. And this sort of haywire of the blood biochemistry has a name from the diabetes literature, which is called accelerated starvation, because this behavior. Sorry.
We're just remembering.
It wasn't my imagination.
Okay.
I was pregnant.
Yeah. All hell was breaking loose. Yeah. This has been called accelerated starvation, and there have been a number of recent studies on Ramadan that show basically exactly this for Ramadan, that when you extend when the mom is fasting for Ramadan, then the blood biochemistry goes crazy. I think, actually, Bosch is working on this, but I think, you know, the leap from Ramadan to thinking about other sort of more commonly experienced. I mean, Ramadan is very commonly experienced, so I think the internal validity question is still really interesting. But I think it's less of a leap to go from Ramadan to things like breakfast skipping than it is to go from, you know, famine to other things. So I think I'm not saying it's complete or it's a perfect thing, but I think we're sort of filling in that a little bit. And so if you can think of a good design in breakfast skipping or this sort of thing, dieting, whatever, like that's going to be great to look at. Okay. So now I want to sort of segue a little bit to poverty, okay? So And I had trouble making this slide just because I think it's something that's like so obvious to everybody. So I apologize for this. It's probably super, super obvious. Poor people experience worse prenatal environments on average. Okay. So if you look at something like neonatal mortality, which is mortality within the first 30 or 28 days, of life, that is thought to register pretty well the prenatal environment, as opposed to post-neonatal mortality, which is more like infection and accidents and stuff like that. And so if you stratify, I'm very proud of using the word stratify, the high SES from the bottom SES, well, indeed you find that there's a substantial gap in the neonatal mortality rates, which would suggest that there's differences in the prenatal environment. Similarly, Anna Iser has some nice work with the National Collaborative Perinatal Project data from the 1960s, where they collected really detailed data on an oversample of low SES households and measured things like cortisol. And cortisol is sort of a frequently invoked stress hormone that in laboratory studies where they can randomly do nasty things to pregnant mice or whatever, that you find effects on the next generation when you manipulate cortisol. And so she has a table that shows that those with normal cortisol levels during pregnancy have on average $42,000 in income, and those with high cortisol levels have lower income. So this is just to say, so if we think the fetal environment is really important and exerts these long-term effects on both health and SES, well, it quickly becomes very relevant the fact that that poor people experience worse environments. So that's sort of one of the drags on subsequent outcomes. So in terms of actual studies on fetal origins and policy, there are relatively few existing studies that look at this. And one of the reasons, I think, is that you have the usual policy evaluation challenges, which everybody's really familiar with, plus this hungry longitudinal data requirement to be able to follow these cohorts forward. Okay, so that just makes it a tougher sort of thing. And again, it's if we had that metric of early life that captured this, then we could sort of we could look at the birth weight as I was there and say, okay, I think I have a good sense of what this policy is going to do in 30 years. But I don't think we have that metric. So there is this disconnect. I think that's a reason why we haven't had as many of these policy studies. That said, I think they're absolutely critical and useful. So I'm going to highlight a few of them, and I've probably omitted some. And then I'll turn to some other issues. So, food stamps rollout in the U.S., that's a paper that's been presented here. I'm not going to talk about that in much detail, just summarize the results. There's a fairly well-known paper by Peter Nilsson that looks in Sweden at a couple of counties where in, I think, end of 1967, they liberalized strong beer sales. And if you've been to Sweden, like, alcohol is really expensive, and it's why they all go, like, out on boats and get drunk, because then they don't have to pay the taxes there. But in 67, they liberalized, the sales outside of the state liquor stores to sell strong beer in grocery stores. And basically, it was just like, debauchery and drunkenness. And such that they had to stop the experiment 8 months later. Okay? What he does is he looks at that cohort that happened to be in utero when suddenly, you know, a lot of people were drinking like crazy. And again, this exercise of looking at the ones that were conceived prior. Ward, so the same Ward that I mentioned before, she has a paper which I'm going to admit I haven't read but looks really intriguing on school immunization policies. So basically, when different states adopted different immunization requirements, she looks at the cohort that was in utero then, so they would have experienced sort of like a herd benefit of having the older kids immunized, and finds long-run effects on outcomes of that. I mentioned this land reform in China for two reasons. One is, I'm going to talk about land reform in China tomorrow, so if you can stand another talk, that'll be me. The other reason is land reform has been called the largest anti-poverty program in the history of the world because it lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. So basically, they decollectivized agriculture, and people gained a lot of agricultural income by being able to farm for themselves. And their long-term effects of that. Okay, I'm actually not talking about the long-term effects tomorrow. I'm talking about short-term effects. But that's another instance where we can map the policy to later life outcomes. And I'm guessing there's a WIC project in the works of long-run effects of WIC. Is that true? Okay. All right. But maybe this is to highlight the need for additional studies. And I've probably omitted some. I was thinking that the Nick Sanders study was a policy one, but then that's the recession, not the long run effects of the Clean Air Act amendment. So I was sort of scratching my head for other studies, but I'm hopeful that there will be more soon. Was that a hand? No. Right. That should have been there. Yes. So there's a study on the, yes. Let me put that and make a note to myself. So there's a sharp reduction in black mortality following the integration of hospitals in the 1960s. And, there's a follow-up paper that looks at basically the test scores of those who were less exposed to diarrhea, et cetera, these major components of mortality, and finds that a big part of the convergence of the test, black-white convergence in the gap, the convergence in the black-white test scores that occurred in the 1980s can be traced back to this convergence in early postnatal health. So they're actually thinking more about the postnatal as opposed to the prenatal period, but you're exactly right. Yes. Yep.
So you mentioned the Nick Sanders paper, and you said, oh, but that's the recession.
Yep.
So I guess I'm curious how you think about effects of sort of broad, either broad or individual economic shocks as fitting into this. So either individual blood loss or being in utero during a deep recession. Do we think of that as, how does that fit in with all of this?
I think my answer is I don't really know. So there are studies like the Vandenberg study in the AER from X years ago, where they actually look at, you know, being born in a being in utero during a recession versus other, and they find effects of that. I think I'm drawing too sharp a distinction here between sort of a common variation and policy induced variation. So when I was talking about Ramadan, I was trying to think of that more as like common variation, and where I don't really know the policy. I don't want to go there either. Versus this, but that may be sort of too sharp a distinction that I'm drawing. Yeah. Okay. So food stamps programs. I'm just going to refresh people's memory that county by county, there's a rollout of the food stamp programs across U.S. counties during the 1960s and 1970s. This is nice because the food stamps program tends to be pretty uniform, in contrast to sort of, you know, other commonly studied things like Medicaid or that sort of thing. And so having sort of some leverage on geographic variation is very helpful, and we can sort of use the sharp timing of when the food stamp program appeared. And this is possible. So there there are a couple of existing papers, and then there's a more recent paper that uses the geo-identified version of the PSID to look at outcomes in adulthood. So now these guys are in their 30s or whatever. How are they doing? And the basic findings are that decades later, we still see positive effects of food stamp programs, and the largest impacts are on health outcomes, and we do see effects for socioeconomic outcomes as well. I think it's important to sort of linger a little bit on this, which is I don't think these impacts were an explicit intention of the original program. So if we think that the original program was somehow the optimal amount of that program, excluding this, it means that we aren't doing enough of that program, okay? So that there are these additional unintended positive impacts of the program, which we're still detecting today, which probably didn't, you know, enter into the congressional debate on how much to fund food stamps in the 1960s. And then this alcohol thing, I probably summarized most of this. There's a large increase in consumption. We can look at the preconceived cohort. Later in life, they have less educational attainment, lower earnings, higher welfare dependency. Hillary, I forgot to address the point about selective attrition, and I meant to do that with Ramadan. He finds selective attrition as well and effects on the sex ratio. So something that's useful and interesting, I guess, is that, you know, as we may know, males are really good at dying at all ages, and that includes in utero. So they're better at dying in utero than females. And that's, you know, that this capacity for dying is one reason given why we see, you know, male bias sex ratios at birth, because, you know, males need a little head start so that they can die off, and then have balanced sex ratios at mating time or whatever. Okay, so what he finds, he sort of separates his analysis into two things. One is to consider the cohort that was already in utero, and one is the endogenously conceived cohort, which is also a really interesting cohort, right? Because you'd expect those aren't exactly the planned births the way the other ones are. And he finds that there are fewer males in the endogenously exposed cohort. So one of these proxies for fetal attrition, since we don't have great metrics of what's the, you know, cohort alive at conception, is the sex ratio at birth. And indeed, he finds that there are fewer males following this temporary policy. And we find the same for Ramadan, that you see basically a decrease in the number of males, but no change in the number of females. So it looked like all that excess fetal mortality was heaped on the males. In that respect, you might be sort of more comfortable making unbiased inferences on the females than the males if there's more selection going on for the males. Oh, and then, like I said, lower earnings, but I didn't say, he also finds higher welfare dependency as well. So this policy seems to have important long-term effects. Okay, now what I want to talk about, I want to talk about two things in my remaining time. One is remediation, mm-hmm. and the second is sort of endogenous investment responses, okay? And the distinction between these two will maybe become clear. I've talked exclusively, well, not quite exclusively, but pretty much exclusively about policies affecting the prenatal period. To what extent has the ship sailed once you're born? So, as mentioned before, some people find fetal origin stuff depressing, you're fated or whatever. Let's think specifically about two treatments. Something bad that happens in utero, and what's the benefit of subsequent remedial interventions to address that bad thing, okay? And these needn't be along the same dimension of capacity. So if you're familiar with the Heckman capacity formation literature, you can think about, you know, health as one dimension of capacity. You could imagine bad health in utero and then maybe some subsequent educational investments that try and ameliorate the effect of that bad health in utero. Okay. Tough to capture empirically. So I think we beat our brains for one instrument or natural experiment to be analyzed about the prenatal period. The problem is with a prenatal instrument, it's not kosher to look at the observed response and put that on the right-hand side. Okay, so say we're looking at prenatal infection with influenza, and say after birth, parents tried to compensate for that damage by spending more time with that child. Okay, that's interesting. And we might look at that, say we observe that,
Okay. So I put it on the left-hand side.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I'm gonna do, that's what I'm gonna do next. We might be tempted to, but Hillary's not, to put the, to put the endogenous response on the right-hand side and then say, okay, what's the return to this parental response to the prenatal period? Okay, and people do that. That's a problem because they're endogenous. Endogenous stuff goes on the left-hand side of the regurgitation, not the right-hand side. And if you want to sort of be further convinced of this, you can read the wonderful section in Angrist and Pischke on endogenous control. Right. I've made this not having a metric point once before. I guess I'm not going to make it here. Okay. What I think we would ideally like is two instruments. So something that messed with the prenatal experience and something that messed with the later life experience and affecting the same cohort. And that's sort of asking for lightning to strike twice, which, and there's at least one paper that actually tries to do this. But I think that's, for my money, that's sort of like what I'd like to see. We'll probably need some huge like population register because, you know, the first thing you do with a natural experiment is you throw out most of your data. And if we're going to do that, you know, twice, you can imagine what we're left with. So that's a challenge there. So what I do here is I run home to theory instead. Okay. And the reason why I run home to theory is because what I think theory tells us, or at least writing down a simple model of which Heckman did, not me, of a developmental technology, of producing adult outcomes, is you don't learn a lot about the return to remediation from finding fetal origins damage. Okay? So that's just what I'm gonna sort of say here quickly in some slides. But there's a disconnect between findings of big fetal origins damage and what that implies for return to remedial investments. Okay? So that's what I'm gonna illustrate here. And this is the running home to theory because I don't have a design where I am going to strike twice with lightning, okay? Heckman did this, like, he's done a lot of brilliant things, but, this is my favorite thing that he did, which is write down a developmental production function. So usually you'd have, like, capital and labor here, okay? Like, capital, labor, and then you'd make something. Instead, what we're doing is we're looking at time. So this is, like, investments during early childhood and investments during late childhood, okay? I just think that this is just so freaking smart, like, to come up with this. So we're just going to use a normal CES production function. And something that's really going to matter is this elasticity of substitution, how substitutable investments are across time in producing health or human capital or whatever the heck it is, okay? And the production function that I think had been implicitly assumed in the literature is something that's more linear. So if phi equals 1, then this thing reduces to, you just have some sort of like coefficient on the prenatal period and some coefficient on the postnatal period, okay? But things get funkier when phi is not equal to 1, okay? And I think one of the things that the fetal origins perspective tells us is we think phi is not equal to 1, okay? And, you know, an intuition for that is, let's say, you know, the elasticity of substitution can vary. It's a parameter here. The extreme case, so this is one extreme case. The other extreme case is Leontief production, okay? In Leontief production, you can't do any better than what you invested in the first period. So the return is zero, you know, above a certain level of investments in the second period, okay? That's the extreme case of this CES production function. Okay, so following this this wonderful chapter with Janet, we look at net investments in the first period by considering, like, the shock to... So we have some fixed level investments, then we consider a shock to those investments. And we're going to assume that the shock, which we index with G just because we often, like with Chernobyl or whatever, look at geographically identified shocks. We're going to look at how the reduced form would be, like, how health changes in response to that prenatal health shock. And if you take, you know, if you if you remember how to take a derivative, then it looks something like that. And we have large fetal origins damage if this thing is substantially less than zero. Because we're holding investments fixed, I have a bar over the I2 here. That's what we're doing when we're thinking about the biological effect. Is like there's no response. The only thing conceptually that changes is this early life shock. Everything else we hold fixed. Okay? So first, it's worth mentioning that even absent a behavioral response, this damage here is a relatively complex function of gamma and phi. So it's not like we've just nailed phi by looking at reduced form damage. Okay? So one implication is large reduced form damage doesn't tell us so much on its own about the substitutability across periods of investment. What I wanted to talk... Okay. That slide is out of order. I'm sorry. I'm gonna talk about remediation in a second. This is not out of order. But there's a poverty aspect here which is really interesting. I got excited about and I really wanted to put it somewhere so it doesn't fit perfectly. But I think it's really cool. So for less than perfect substitutability between periods, there's diminishing marginal productivity of the investment inputs. Okay? So shocks experienced at different baseline levels of investment have heterogeneous effects on H. So other things equal, those with higher baseline levels of investment will experience more muted effects on H than those where baseline investments are low. So basically, I'm just talking about variation in I bar 1. Okay? If you're in a like low investing family, then we expect bigger fetal origins damage to the extent this thing is, you know, concave. A recurring finding from the earlier fetal origins literature, and I think the seminal paper in this is by Curry and Heisen in 1999, is that long-term damage due to shocks is more likely in low SES families, okay? Now, one interpretation which has been given to this fact of larger fetal origins damage in low SES families is that poor families are just subject to more shocks, okay? So it's not really that there's a different effect, it's just that there's more treatment. In the context of this production function thing, it's actually pretty natural that the same shock will have a greater impact on children and poor families if the low baseline level of investment is low to begin with, okay? And that's because they're on a steeper portion of the production function that would accentuate the effect of equivalent size mu g shock, okay? So that's something that just naturally falls out of writing down the CES production function. So you could think of it sort of in the emitted variables bias way or just sort of the production technology way. And they're both sort of explaining the same heterogeneity. Now the question that I was actually trying to answer, which was, is it possible to alter bad early trajectories? So what's the effect of a mu g prime shock? So a shock experienced in the, say, postnatal period during the second period on H. And we're going to be interested in what's the remediation potential to the extent that 2, which was the fetal origins damage, is particularly large in absolute value. Okay? And this is what this ratio is here. It's the effectiveness of remediation relative to the initial damage. So how much of that problem can we undo with sort of higher investments along the same dimension later in life? And again, what I'd sort of emphasize here is it's not like this phi is telling us what this thing is. I'm going to repeat it up on the next slide. The effectiveness of remediation relative to the initial damage, if I bar 1 is greater than I bar 2 and a given value gamma, then a unit of remediation will be more effective at low elasticities of substitution. So that's like a more developmental production function. It was the lack of I2 that was the more critical shortfall prior to the shock. Whereas if I bar 1 is less than I2, then a high elasticity of substitution increases in the effectiveness of remediation. Okay? So what this says to me is if you write down which fortunately Heckman did, a sort of workhorse model of developmental production technology, we really don't know a priori how effective remediation is going to be. So we can't sort of give up and say, okay, there's big damage, we can't do anything. You know, we don't really know until we look at it, okay? Again, for my money, I'd like to see situations where lightning strikes twice, but maybe there are other ways at this. And I think that's actually why I mentioned the metric point earlier. If we had that metric, we wouldn't really need to be observing the same cohort and that sort of thing. Okay. All right. So now this is my last section and sort of, I think, on time. So I wanted to tell this brief Ed Glaser story, which I at least thought was pretty funny. When I was presenting my flu paper, like in a sort of practice job talk at Harvard, Ed Glaser sort of came up to me afterwards. He's an economist who's more into theory than I am, for sure. And he said, I believe what you said here, but I'd just like to see some behavior here. You know, just some people doing something. And I said, and this was really obnoxious for someone who was on the job market, said, you know what? That's why this is a good paper. Okay? That was a totally obnoxious thing to say to Ed Glaser. It felt so good to say it. I have to say, I still feel good that I said that to him. It's not really even true. And that's what I think he was ahead of his time. He was right and I was wrong. But it was really gratifying to say that to him. The early origins papers have looked at this reduced form effect of delta H on delta mu G. Whether this represents a purely biological effect, is open to question. And sort of what's in the mix is whether there are responsive, investments. To the extent that early origins are important. So if you have a more developmental production technology, there's going to be more incentive of the parents to respond to that birth endowment, okay? Because you got some funkiness of returns going on, okay? So it's not just, Heckman, I really like his quote where he says, economics has degenerated to the state of a New Yorker article. Like just all these sort of clever little papers without modeling or behavior or stuff like that. I like the New Yorker, so I thought that was kind of funny that Heckman thinks so little of the New Yorker. But this isn't just navel-gazing by economists, okay? Yes, we're interested in behavior, but it really seems to be something that could respond to fetal origins because these returns are so different depending on what happened during the prenatal period. Okay, so for expositional purposes, consider mu g less than zero responses that either magnify or attenuate the initial change. So additional reasons why we might be interested in the endogenous postnatal investment response is, unless these investment responses are costless, which seems pretty unlikely, damage estimates that monetize the change in health or change in wages with respect to that prenatal shock are going to understate the total damage, okay? So there's an earlier literature on pollution and health effects of pollution that looks at behavioral responses to pollution and finds that there's a large role of behavior in mitigating exposure and effects of pollution. If that sort of mitigation behavior were completely effective, we would find no delta H. So H doesn't get affected, and there is a shock. And people are doing all this unobserved stuff that's costly to them, like buying inhalers or staying indoors or whatever it is. And we would incorrectly conclude from the reduced form relationship between health and the shock that nothing really happened, whereas there's all this costly behavior going on, okay? That's sort of a similar intuition for going on here. The damage caused by early life shocks will be understated if they're compensatory investment responses. So basically, if second period investments respond in the opposite direction as that first period shock, okay? And so I think this compensatory investments is what people think usually goes on. Like, this is people's priors, is that you have like an unhealthy kid and you sort of, you invest more in that kid. And we need to cost those investments as well if those are positive. The interesting thing is, even when the response is reinforcing, the total costs are still going to be understated by focusing on the reduced form damage, a point which I'm not going to develop here, but basically, if that weren't the case, We need to deduct the fact that parents have lower utility by virtue of their kids being prenatally messed up. Otherwise, parents would mess up their kids prenatally and be happy about it. This fetal origins of parental response is not even a working paper yet, but will be soon. It's a review, and review is kind of a premature thing because there really aren't very many papers on this. So I don't really, it's more of a call to arms, like this is really interesting or something. There are empirical studies that look at within family estimates. So like that earlier literature that looked at fetal origins effects, this is doing a similar thing, but looking at how do parental investment decisions within the family respond to the birth endowment differences within the family. And then there, you know, you won't be surprised for me to say some maybe more convincing estimates, design-based estimates that look at basically what were postnatal investments as we can infer them from later life outcomes, like that Chernobyl study, say, why the heck are sibling fixed effects estimates larger than the straight D&D estimates, okay? We're inferring from that parents reinforced it, but we don't actually observe the investments. We'd love to, but we don't. And then better studies that actually observe the postnatal measure and have a design-based strategy. Okay. So this is sort of the money table in that, which we just put together. And one thing I guess to note here is that these dates tend to be really pretty recent, and few of these are actually published, okay? I think our prior, as I mentioned, is that parents probably compensate endowment differences. The interesting thing from this sort of early survey is we do seem to see responses, but if you had to pick a winner, we would say that responses are either zero or reinforcing. We're finding more studies in the reinforcing, and I'll highlight my favorite study, which is nice because it's not actually by me, is this long-run effects of iodine supplementation in Tanzania. Okay, so you're probably familiar with the study by Erica Field and co-authors where they looked at prenatal supplementation with iodine, which obviously was done for the reasons that it has cognitive impacts. What these guys do is they use the demographic health survey data and look at how do parents' investment measures respond to that rollout. And they find very strong evidence that parents basically invested more in that more cognitively able kid by virtue of the iodine supplementation. Okay? And they make this point as well, and I'll stress it here, and I think this is going to be my last slide, because I don't think I'm going to talk about other ones here. Okay, first off, there seems to be responsive behavior. Let me delay what I was about to say and stay on the boat here. Family fixed effect studies, which were the sort of the initial way of identifying long-run effects, like the Black et al. Study for Norway, they had these behavioral responses sort of baked in, right? So you can imagine, you know, relatively comparisons across families, when we look within families, we're accentuating whatever that responsive behavior is. So to the extent that parents are reinforcing birth endowment differences, then maybe these family fixed effects estimates are actually giving us an overestimate of the biological effect. Okay? Now that's not to say that fetal origins are overblown, because we still want to cost what that behavioral response was, but we, you know, part of that informing policy, I think, is having a notion of what the biological effects out there are. Now, that said, say it is the case that the emerging consensus is that parents reinforce endowment differences rather than compensate them. And again, that's not so surprising when you write down the developmental technology. And that's the reason for that is you can still have parental preferences for equality across kids, okay? And you can have strong preferences for equality across kids. The question is whether that preference for equality is stronger than the funkiness of the developmental production function, okay? And I think the fetal origins literature is saying that developmental production function is pretty funky, okay? And if it's sufficiently funky, then I can really want equality among my kids, but it's just not worth my time. Like, it's just too much to overwhelm whatever bad thing happened in utero. So I really want to compensate, but it's just hitting my head against a brick wall here, given the technology. Okay, so this is to say that I don't think we learn a lot about parental preferences from saying that that reinforcement is common. Okay, if you believe that the technology of development is sufficiently funky, and I do believe it's pretty funky. And as I mentioned before, policy care is not just about biology, but also that parental response, which may be tough to cost and tough to measure. And that response, you know, obviously affects utility, so we got to cost that, even if they reinforce. Okay, so I'm on my last slide. Conclusions. Fetal origin effects tend to be large, to the chagrin of people who study some later life interventions. And also, you know, as maybe I didn't emphasize enough, is, you know, the prenatal period is brief, and people often find effects, like with Ramadan, that's like 28 days. You know, that's so much shorter than class size reduction or these other things that, you know, you need to persist over a couple of years. It's like an order of magnitude shorter. Economics, some people define as what's the optimal allocation of scarce resources. What fetal origins encourages us to do, but, you know, hasn't delivered, and I'm part of the problem in not delivering on this just yet, is how do we optimally allocate resources across the life cycle, okay? And what I think there is there's an opportunity to reallocate existing resources and improve outcomes, okay? So it's like the ounce of prevention versus the pound of cure. We're doing a bit, with respect to child investments, I think we're doing more pound of cure. We're only beginning to understand how to do this. So this isn't sort of like my mission accomplished victory lap. I think, we really need to inform this, going forward. Initial results are encouraging that suggest multiplier effects of certain public policies, except when you let people drink. But there are going to be these challenges, which I've mentioned before, is that there's this long time elapsed. And Doug Miller, who unfortunately isn't here, right? He refers to this as a science fiction problem. Is that we can't sort of, you know, look at our data now and then go back in time and then do something, these guys, and observe the outcomes. We're sort of left with, necessarily conducting some economic history in the absence of a reliable metric, which turns out birth weight doesn't seem to be. I'm beating up on birth weight here. I'm not sure that there's a better metric than birth weight. It's just not the most reliable. And then there are these important nuances posed by behavioral responses, which if you're an economist, you might be interested in per se, but they also might substantially affect what we view as the actual biological effect of the prenatal period. And then I just put this here just not because it fits, but just because I want to sort of, this seems like something that has not been studied very much and would be really interesting to see, is whether fostering early pregnancy recognition changes behavior and exerts long-run effects. Thanks. Yes?
So you've only talked about evidence from natural experiments. Is there scope to run, say, $1 billion
Absolutely.
Experiment?
Yes. So we, in this paper that's not yet a working paper, there's actually a section on that I think people's knee-jerk is that it's unethical to do this, but there actually have been experiments run that...
You can do some positive ones.
You can do some positive ones. So exactly. So there's a study which I'm trying to follow in Harlem that randomly gave out nutritional supplements to low-income women. So exactly as you said, you can do positive one. There's a Harvard grad student who's conducting a random nutritional supplement in the developing world somewhere. And there are some studies in the biomedical literature looking at relatively younger ages where they also randomly assign. So absolutely, I think with these positive things, that's another thing which I appreciate your mentioning, because it's only a matter of time before people are doing those as well. And so the controlled experiments with these things, I think that's going to happen. I mean, it has happened, and people are going to analyze it. Yep.
I would love to see a back-of-the-envelope calculation that took all the additional money we spend on poor children once they hit the education system, and if instead we had provided food take the famine, even this natural experiment as your counterexample, and had spent all that money supplying food for those people, what would the what would the longer term outcomes look like?
Right.
Just to get this idea of trade-offs of yeah. these different policy levers in the forefront.
Yeah, that needs doing, and people here may know better than I will, but I think Heckman's gotten closer to that than certainly. Well, I don't want to use me and Heckman in the same sentence, but he has sort of figures where he's done some of those about the return early versus a return late, which I think that should be in this presentation, which is yes. Yeah.
I can't help but think of something similar in terms of, say, like the Affordable Care Act, which means in November, but access to health care and preventative services, whether it's through the health exchanges or through Medicare expansion, or similar. I know not having preventative care isn't necessarily like a specific event that causes trauma.
Yep. Well, and actually that's a point which I don't think appeared in the slides, which I should have made, which is there are all these existing studies of programs like, you know, Medicaid variation across states that look at birth outcomes, and I don't know of studies that have traced the long-term effects. So I think one sort of natural place to go is to look at those sort of well-identified studies that have just looked at birth outcomes and now sort of see if we can link those to long-term effects. And so Medicaid is a very natural thing to do that for. And the study you asked about with hospital desegregation is sort of doing that as well. So I think you're exactly right that some of these access things, you know, it's very plausible to think those have long-term effects as well. Thank you very much.
I'm calling Cameron.
Oh, very nice to meet you.
No, I'm very sad Doug's not with you.
So you're going to be back in March. I mean, hell, it's right in my like, sweet spot, so I could, you know, thank you.
You're here.
This makes me feel so happy.
So,